Question number 30493, Reel 4.
Reel 4. I was just going to ask if you'd be able to describe a bit more about the barracks. And
barracks, it was just, if I remember, in Yorkshire, we were at some camp, and it would have been really primitive, you know. I forgot what you call them, Nissen huts, I suppose, those curved steel or iron living, so-called living quarters. Are very primitive, and we're all about, I suppose, always about 2 dozen blokes. Now, I remember very little about that. As I say, the drawing came up. There again, there's so many hours, you're just bloody bored, you know. It's the story of army life, 90% of it, I think. And I took up drawing, sketching, and as I say, I did physical sketches, but mostly copied from newspapers. And occasionally I did from life, and I've got one of some mates cleaning their rifles and giving quite a nice image of life in a barrack room. And I don't think I carried my sketching out of Britain. I think I gave it up as soon as we got on the ship. It's too difficult to do any artwork under. Anyway, it showed a sort of a certain part of my interest. And of course the camera took over from then.
Was that something you'd taken up only in joining the army?
No, I got interested in photography in the late 30s, I suppose. Just casual photography, but I gradually improved it and got keen about it. And I was certainly very anxious to take photographs right through the war. And I think I said, we got into action when the order came round, hand in all cameras. I think I've told you this story, I may have done. I approached my CO and said, excuse me, sir, I'd like to continue to use my camera, and that I believe that in King's regulations, it's something about each unit being allowed a unit cameraman. That's what's in my memory. It may be true, it may be not. But I did produce some argument that resulted in the permit to hold my camera, even though, you know, we were going into action. The cameras were forbidden. As a result, I was once arrested on the battlefield by a sergeant major who happily, I was wandering around the battlefield, and a sergeant major from another unit spotted me. Oi! Luckily, he accepted the official permission, which I carried around with me, of course.
How did the rest of your unit feel about you taking photos?
Ah, well, it was interesting, you know. It's an interesting thing about... I was interested in what you might call candid photography. That is, I hated anybody to notice me. Now, of course, if you're the guy in the unit, Joe Gray, I was Joe in the army, you know. Old Joe carries a cap. I mean, I become invisible, like the postman, you know. You don't notice the postman, because he comes with the letters every day. Yeah, he didn't notice me because I had a camera around my neck all the time. So I could snap away merrily as I was an invisible man. Lovely. Just perfect. But then, whenever I got into, I was a great visitor. If there was any opportunity at all to visit a nearby town or village or some historical monument, you know, I'd be out there, and then I'd be among the local people. And there again, I could photograph with care. I'd photograph the Jews at the Wailing Wall. Now, they didn't like that, you see, so you really had to try and be invisible there. Without offending them. I got one or two nice photos of quite close up of Jews at the charging their prayers at the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem, and also in the Arab ghetto. I've got a lovely shot of an Arab, I assume he was praying, through this iron lattice window, and that's one of my favourite photos, and there he's quite unaware of me, and there's just this solitary figure beyond the frame of the window. That sort of thing fascinated me. And of course we would see picture posts occasionally, old issues would turn up everywhere, and Life magazine, and these guys on Life magazine, you know, they were the world's brilliant photographers, Cartier, Bresson, people like that, and I used to stare at these incredible photos and think, I had no chance of really emulating them, but they were they were the masters, and I always had them in my head when I pointed the camera at anything. And so it was a fascination that really kept me, well, unbored. Now, this is defeated boredom. This is what I think is essential in the army. You have got to somehow defeat boredom. And for me, it was photography, the diary, and books. And the interesting thing is, I'm leaping ahead rather, but because I was a professional, I volunteered for the regular army, and I kept quiet about that. I never mentioned it to the other guys. It didn't make any difference, of course, except that when they all went home in 1945, I had two more bloody years to serve. Now, this is a very interesting... I don't know what I'm going to say about those 2 years, because there is a sort of black hole. I had to go back to Italy. Now, this is the biggest regret of my life. I had another year to serve in the occupying army in Italy. AMGOT, Allied Military Government of Occupied Territories. Now, I was part of that. There was absolutely nothing to do. It's a great hole in my life. But why did I not do my damnedest to learn the language properly? That's a terrible failure in my life. There's a whole year out there, and it is just a black hole. It's terrible, really. I mean, actually, you see, it explains why I thought I had to seek psychiatric help when I came out of the army. I mean, it wasn't severe. I wasn't exactly suicidal. But I like to think it's what Churchill called his black dog. You see, I thought, well, if Churchill could suffer from black dog depression, I don't see why I shouldn't have a bit of that, you know.
You mentioned the boredom. How did other people cope with that?
Yeah, oh, well, do you have to ask? I mean, housey, I mean, card games of every kind. Now, kicking the ball around whenever there was a chance. Well, I used to participate in, you know, kicking the ball around. They developed this housey game with money passed around, you know. You heard of housey millionaires, stories like that. And I don't know, dirty stories. I've heard every dirty story that's ever invented in the army. They all sort of challenge one another. They go on and on and on around the barrack room, all the tent, you know, all the trench. That was how they cope with boredom. That's how the average bloke. I mean, you have to remember that army was a product of the 1930s. It's impossible today to, you know, the consumer society now It's all part in the past and hidden. It's terrible. Economically and intellectually, poverty of the 30s. Terrible. And I was in with that, all those lads, all about the same age. My only advantage, I left school at 14, like all they had. My only advantage, I suppose, was, I suppose it had been the influence of my mother that suddenly steered me a bit to the sort of, what should we say, vaguely intellectual interests, you know, like reading and theatre, cinema. I used to tune into American comedy shows. I used to sit up till 1 o'clock in the morning to get the nightly Jack Benny show, and as a result, I developed a sort of intense interest in American humour and jokes, which stood me very well when I got into the army. I could conjure up, what with my steel spectacles and, you know, my Americanisms, I became Joe. And that helped me enormously because I had the problem of cigarettes being offered to me from day one. Sorry, mate, I don't smoke, you know. I got fed up with that. So I took up chewing gum. So what with my chewing gum, my steel spectacles, my American jokes, it was a good sort of facade in the army. Instead of me being a sort of odd man out, I did fit in after all, which was very pleasing for me because my interests were all so different from all the guys around me, really. But they were comrades, you know. That's it, that's the word. Something that's very hard to communicate.
How had you managed to take...
Sorry?
How did you avoid managing to take up smoking previously?
Sorry?
How was it that you managed to avoid smoking?
I wonder. I've often wondered about this. I mean, I must have been rather a prudish young man, you know. But what made me like that? Again, might have been my influence of my mother. She was Irish, and she was a Catholic, of course. Not a very devout one. I don't remember going to church. She might have done. So I had religious ideas until... I mean, the war swept them all away. Oh, my God, yes. You know, God, a God... presiding over all this slaughter and killing. What kind of God is that, you know? That was the end of religion for me. But I think I got some critical in my late teens. But it might have stuck, you know, a religious code in one way. I might have absorbed what was good about it rather than rejecting it totally. And smoking. Well, of course... My father was a chronic smoker, and he always tried to give it up. And when he was trying to give it up, he was a bastard, you know. He's bad-tempered and irritable, and that put me off. I thought, my God, why start smoking if that's what it does to you? And the schools were very good at that time. I remember a horrifying lecture about smoking, and they put these slides to the... in the sort of magic lantern thing, which was the equivalent then day of a cine, and showed these x-ray photos of smokers' lungs, and an operation, they sort of removed this lung, which was sort of like a tar dripping off it. That was a great deterrent, you know, great deterrent. Another great deterrent in Cairo, in 1942, there's a museum there which I thought every soldier ought to visit. Half a dozen of us went into this museum. Now, what was it called? the Museum of Sexual Hygiene or something like that. It's quite an extensive place, and it's all devoted to sexual diseases. I mean, it's, anybody who likes horror films ought to visit that museum. In, there are wax figures of sexual organs and every kind of decay and that you can imagine, you know, showing the effects of this, that and the other, of different disease. You know, we went round there with our eyes wide open and came out feeling ill. That was certainly a deterrent against casual sex, I can tell you. I didn't, you know, the army used to lecture about sexual activity and provided condoms for anybody who wanted a normal lecture. But I must say, I thought, well, of course, everywhere you went, the army had red light, you know, a red light district. I mean, any town had a red light district. I'm totally out of bounds with military police. It wasn't easy for any soldier to break the rules or gamble on a prostitute, you know. So there we are. I was rather prudish about and swearing. Today, of course, you know, where everybody's language is laced with the F word, you know. And Ken in Thailand is the first man to say fuck on the BBC. You know? That's a historic occasion. I was surrounded with that language for 7 years, and I learned not to use it. I'd developed my own vocabulary and defied the mass use of foul language. I mean, not through any... Now, just because I loved the English language, I think, you know, I didn't see the need... I thought, oh, these guys, they don't read books, you know, they can't express themselves in any other way. I just saw them. And, of course, swearing in the hands of a master is a sort of art and a rhythm, very impressive, you know. You get a sentence with of six words in which five of them begin with F. That's quite an achievement, really. So it's weird, you know. There I was with these weird, prudish ideas, and yet I got by in the army without being made a butt or a fool of. Strange, really. Lucky, wasn't I?
Going back to your camera, what sort of equipment were you using?
Well, don't forget, what was the pay like then? 3 shillings a day, I think we got. 15 pence a day. Of course, it was a lot more then, but it was a rudimentary pay. I was paid 3 shillings a day, 21 shillings a week, 1 guinea a week at the beginning of the war, and at the end of the war, when I came out, I was getting 7 shillings a day, you know, 50, under 50 bob a week. It didn't leave much margin for luxuries or... And, of course, I had to make... photography are profitable. Actually, I've got somewhere. I found a notebook in which I kept a careful counting of expenses and receipts from the lads and some of the officers. I used to sell the. We often there in the tent, sorting photos and all photo orders out, running a little business really. But I broke even at the end. I didn't make a profit. I just broke even. You know, cost of camera, film, posting them off to London. And the camera, initially, I went into the army with a little camera called a Perma camera. And it was a little Bakelite camera with a clever little device, a little weight inside. If you held it up vertically, it would be say a 30th shutter speed, and then if you tipped it horizontally, you get something like a 100th, and then if you tipped it the other way, vertically, you get 150th of shutter speed. The lens was rudimentary, really. I think 4.5 or 5.6, but you know, I could take photos with it. Now, it was a roll field camera, so suddenly in the Middle East, I was hunted every opportunity I had to find a photo shop or camera shop. I'd be seeking roll film, but it ran out because the army took all the roll film for aerial photography. They needed thousands of miles of it there as they photograph occupied Europe. But, so it disappeared, you couldn't buy it. So 35mm came into its own. Now I discovered I could buy, from order from Wallace Heaton in London, 100-foot cans, 35mm film. Panatomic X, lovely. So when I discovered that possibility, I began to order cans of film. Now, it meant that you had to load your own cassettes. Now, you didn't have a dark room going well with you in the army. So very often I was under several layers of blankets at night time with the door shut, or the tent door shut. And there I was with these blankets in the dark, hopefully in the dark, cutting the film to proper length and feeding it into the cassettes. I became quite skilled at judging the right length, and then having to cut the leader so it would fit into the camera properly. It's tricky, but that's how I did it. And the first time I adapted the roll film camera, when the roll film ran out, I adapted my roll film camera to take 35mm. That meant changing the frame of the viewfinder. It meant blacking out the little windows in the back that you judge the movement of the film. And it meant, with no guide to how much film you were using, you had to work out the number of turns it needed to move the frame from one on, move on to the next one. So it was really a challenging thing, taking photographs. Then happily, I think in Tel Aviv, I spotted, and still had money in my pocket for once, I spotted a Kodak 35mm camera, which I find I've paid £12.50 for it. And from then on, I had a 35mm camera, not a very powerful lens, unhappily, there again it was probably 4.5. But there we are, it saw me through the rest of the war. If you want the end of the photo story, not being a smoker was a great advantage because I had, I bought my ration of cigarettes. I forgot what it was, the horrible cigarette, the guys hated it, it's called the V for Victory cigarette. So I had my ration of V for Victory cigarettes every week, which might have been, I don't know, what did they allow the troops? 10 a day, I suppose, 10, that would be 10, perhaps 50 or 100 a week, for a free issue. So I took my ration, and, well, of course, I have to say, I have to admit this, I participated in the black market. But remember, there was no campaign then about smoking is dangerous for you. Smoking was the great alleviator of pain and worry. Everybody smoked, you know. How much smoke, as a non-smoker, I must have breathed in from crowded tents and dugouts and barracks. I can't imagine. Anyway, I was able to sell. No problem at all. When I accumulated a sizable quantity, no trouble finding a buyer. And so Lira changed hands. And I began to save up for a Leica camera, because you could, if you went to a camera shop, it usually they would have a Leica, and this was the, you know, the camera. And about, I didn't have enough for it until we got to Genoa. We were stationed in Genoa, just in the last days of the war, or the war was even over. So I got the Leica very late in the day, and I remember the army gave me a holiday in the Alps, a skiing holiday, you know, in the Alps, a week. And I took the Leica with me and got these lovely snow photos. I can continue this story if you like. It's part of my depression that because I bought it in Italy, it was liable for confiscation the moment I got home. And we were told that we were not to bring cameras or whatever. I know there was some warning about it. So I had to, when finally I got home in 1945 for a month's leave, I had to hang the camera under my shirt and hide the lens in my pocket and pray that I wasn't stopped on the getting off the ship. And when I had to go back to Italy, I thought, well, I can't smuggle it back in and smuggle it back out, because the moment it would be seized, I'd be liable for, I don't know, for £20 tax on it, you see. And that was a fortune then. Anyway, the end of that story is I sold the Leica in 1947 and it helped me to buy a bookshop. So there's a happy end.
While in Yorkshire, what sort of relationship did the recruits and soldiers have with the local population?
I remember, my memory is, we were pretty isolated from the, I mean, when we were in Nottingham, I told you we were largely involved in coal shifting. It was a terrible, terrible winter, 1941, just an awful year. Nothing but defeat on the news. The only consolation was endless supply of films that they ran at the film at the cinemas, and there we were delivering coal and collecting waste paper, you know, just helping the war effort that way. And we were supposed to be trained soldiers to defend the country or attack the enemy. Population, I was. Well, the civilians are all going about their jobs, you know, and all depressed and, oh, what a dreary time it was. You can't comprehend it. Today, I mean, how many words would I have to come out with to fully describe defeated Britain with a defeated army? Oh, terrible, terrible. And they're around the world, the Nazis, the fascists, the Japanese, the Italians, the Germans, they were winning, So I don't know, we were all in the same boat, you see. Civilians, you asked me for separate, we weren't separate, you know. We were all there together, and we were all fearing. I mean, all the major cities were being bombed. Coventry devastated, and London, endless bombing, the stories, you know. I mean, you know all the stories were censored. You know it was all much worse than you were told on the radio and in the papers. I can't see it in terms of army and civilian. We were just a people under terrible threat. And if some of the people didn't know that, I can't believe it, you know. I certainly was aware of it, you know. And it was a terrible year. And I say, the high moment was when in Yorkshire these spanking new 25-pounder guns came out of the factories And there was sort of, there was some sort of, well, you know, like, God, yes, we'll be able to fight back. We've got guns now. And I kind of, the civilian just, no, we're a nation under terrible threat. And except for, you know, SPIDs and a few gangs, as they went on doing their spivvery and their gangsterism, as they always will under all circumstances. But the vast majority of the people, some escaped to Canada and America or elsewhere. Some people had bolt holes. It's sad that some poets who'd been on the left, they suddenly turned up in America, in Hollywood. Oh, well.